Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Radio Havana, Cuba, NHK Japan, Spanish National Radio, and Russia's Sputnik Radio. We'll begin with Radio Havana, Cuba. In the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in 2017, Trump suggested selling off Puerto Rico, according to former Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke. A viewpoint on Trump's speeches at the Southern Command headquarters and at the Jesus Worship Center, both in Florida. The coup government of Bolivia intends to postpone the election set for September. Radio Havana, Cuba.
U.S. President Donald Trump suggested selling Puerto Rico to the highest bidder in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, which plummeted the U.S. colony in 2017, according to a former acting Homeland Security Secretary, Elaine Duke. Duke, who served almost a year in the Trump administration after replacing John Kelly in an acting capacity in July 2017, told the New York Times that she was shocked when the president raised the issue at a meeting on the devastation in Puerto Rico. Trump's first reaction to the hurricane, she said, was to suggest that the United States should either just sell it or divest from the island. In an interview which was published over the weekend in the New York Times, she said the president's initial ideas were more of that as a businessman. Can we outsource the electricity? Can we just sell the island, you know, or divest it from that asset? Duke is the latest former Trump cabinet member to speak out against the president, claiming her former boss cares very little about policy, often resorts to hate-filled, angry, and divisive language instead. She said there is a singular view that strength is mean, that any kind of ability is to be angry, and that is not a weakness. Puerto Rico has been a frequent target of Trump's rage since Mayor Carmen Yulan Cruz criticized the slow and inadequate federal response to the hurricane 3 years ago, which killed more than 3,000 people, left much of the island without running water and electricity for months. Now we find out that Donald Trump was thinking that he would just sell Puerto Rico.
Donald Trump, feeling distressed for the recent information that the voting intentions are showing adverse results in the state of Florida, one of his traditional fiefdoms, made a trip to that city determined to counter the threat of an announced debacle. Once there, the president spoke at Southern Command headquarters and the so-called Jesus Worship Center, a church founded by the Cuban-born pastor Frank Lopez, and place where part of the counter-revolutionary opposition meets. As has been previously denounced, one of the members of such a select congregation was Alexander Alasso, the man who shot at the Cuban embassy in Washington, and who's currently enjoying the protection of justice and research bodies of the United States. In his speeches, Trump told several lies and also committed significant omissions. At the Southern Command, the president lied when he said that the alleged anti-drug operation carried out against Venezuela about 3 months ago had been a resounding success. He may have some problems in geography, but in any case we could remind him that the drugs consumed by the American citizens, the world's largest market, are produced and exported in Colombia, whose president is Trump's great friend. Other substances come from the neighboring Mexico, and opioids come from the militarily occupied Afghanistan. In any case, Venezuela is not recognized as a drugs producer or seller country. He also confirmed that the aggressions against Cuba and Venezuela will continue, which, according to him, are under control. A monumental nonsense. During his speech at the Jesus Worship Center, he promised to defeat socialism, but forgot to mention that this system endowed Cuba with a worldwide success in the fight against COVID-19.
Luis Arce, candidate of Bolivia's Movement Towards Socialism, says that the de facto government intends to postpone the elections set for September the 6th. During an interview with Telesur, he also denounced the attacks on popular forces and the acts of corruption that have taken place in the country, in Bolivia, since the coup d'etat there against Evo Morales last November. He said the intention of the right wing is to prolong the elections, to take them beyond 2020. Democracy was taken from us in November last year. We understand that the Supreme Electoral Tribunal has the same reading to carry out the elections. The presidential candidate of MAS, the Movement Towards Socialism, Lucho Arce, rejected the position of other candidates who, in view of the low popularity, joined the campaign to postpone the election. Luis Arce said, "The Bolivian people are pinning their hopes on the elections to solve the crisis of the pandemic by a de facto government that does not pose a solution to the problem and is now deepening the economic crisis in the country." He said it is necessary to give clarity and certainty to Bolivians who live in the country and have hope for the future.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's web stream worked well this week at their website, radiohc.cu, and their download links are fixed and working great. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. Next, NHK World Radio Japan. The record-breaking rainfalls in Japan have slowed down, but threats of flooding and landslides continue. The Trump administration is stepping up pressure on China over the crackdown on Hong Kong. Pompeo has threatened China over a potential development in the South China Sea, which provoked a Chinese response. He also offered support for any country in the region that will speak out against China. NHK Japan.
Weather officials in Japan say the worst may be over for areas devastated by intense downpours. But as the rain moves south, authorities are warning of continued threat of landslides. Water has begun to recede in Shimane, where a swollen river inundated homes, many filling up to the ceiling. Evacuation orders in Gotsu City remain in place for more than 6,000 people.
I'm glad that the worst part of the rain is over, but I'm worried that the ground looks unstable in some places.
Rescue efforts continue in the southwest. More than a dozen people are still missing, and another 76 have died. The government says 14,000 houses spread across half the country's prefectures have been damaged or destroyed. Affected areas are also dealing with new concerns about the coronavirus. Hundreds of people from across the country have been flown in to help with relief efforts, including a nurse who tested positive for the virus. Officials are now testing about 400 people who may have been in contact with them.
It's essential to recruit manpower from outside Kumamoto to promote reconstruction efforts. What we need are measures to make sure that everyone coming in is free of the virus.
The central government estimates the current damage to the agriculture, forestry, and fishery industries to be over $170 million. The U.S. president is stepping up pressure on China over its crackdown on Hong Kong. Donald Trump signed an executive order ending preferential economic and trade treatment for the territory.
Hong Kong will now be treated the same as mainland China. No special privileges, no special economic treatment, and no export of sensitive technologies.
Trump also signed into law a bill aimed at holding China accountable for what he calls oppressive actions against Hong Kong. It allows the U.S. to impose sanctions on Chinese authorities and financial institutions that contribute to the removal of Hong Kong's autonomy. That could include freezing their assets. The U.S. is also weighing in on primaries held over the weekend to choose pro-democracy candidates in Hong Kong's upcoming Legislative Council elections. The territory's government warned the unofficial vote may have violated China's new national security law. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the warning demonstrates the Chinese Communist Party's fear of democracy and its own people's free thinking. The United States says nothing is off the table when it comes to responding to Chinese aggression in the South China Sea. A war of words has been brewing between the two countries over Chinese development in disputed waters. Speaking at an online forum, a senior U.S. official went so far as to threaten sanctions against Chinese officials and companies operating in the area.
There is room for that. This is a language Chinese understand. It's demonstrative and tangible action.
Stilwell stressed that the U.S. will stand on the side of Southeast Asian nations, which control the waters, if China sets up equipment to drill for natural resources. The warning came after U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo broke with his country's historically neutral stance on the issue, calling China's claims for most of the South China Sea completely unlawful. Then Beijing hit back.
The U.S. statement breaches the promise Washington made to not take sides on South China Sea issues. It violates and distorts international law, provokes maritime and territorial disputes, and damages regional peace and stability, which is irresponsible.
Zhao also denied U.S. claims that China wants to build a maritime empire, instead saying it's shown utmost restraint. Meanwhile, China says it will impose sanctions on a U.S. defense contractor, Lockheed Martin, for selling weapons to Taiwan. Beijing described the move as a necessary measure to safeguard national interests.
China firmly urges the U.S. to honor its commitment to the One China Principle and the China-U.S. joint communiques and stop selling arms to and having military ties with Taiwan.
Last week, the U.S. approved a $620 million upgrade package for Taiwan's surface-to-air missiles. The U.S. does not have formal diplomatic relations with Taiwan, but is bound by law to provide ways for the island to defend itself. Taiwan is currently in the midst of its annual large-scale military drills. The five-day exercise is based on a potential invasion by China. It's unclear when the sanctions will be implemented. Lockheed Martin hasn't yet to respond. The United States is pledging support for any countries that say China has made illegal claims of their territory.
I think you're seeing countries all throughout Asia and indeed in Southeast Asia and in the Pacific recognizing that the United States is prepared to do the things necessary to assist them in protecting their valid legal claims.
The statement expands on Pompeo's earlier comments that China's vast maritime claims are completely unlawful. A State Department spokesperson told NHK the U.S. recognizes Japan's administrative control of the Senkaku Islands. Under Article 5 of a bilateral security treaty, both countries are obligated to respond to an armed attack against such territories. Japan controls the islands. China and Taiwan claim them. The Japanese government maintains the islands are an inherent part of Japan's territory in terms of history and international law. It says there is no issue of sovereignty to be resolved over them.
Those reports were from NHK Radio Japan. They have altered their schedule and format and are now heard from 9:30 to 10 p.m. at 5975-7245 and 11970, or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. On to Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio. Allison Hughes reports on Turkey's rejection of a ceasefire in Libya, while Egypt was asked to intervene directly in the civil war. Access to the oil ports in Libya is what is at stake, with the two battling Libyan governments backed by various other nations. Last Friday, a tanker was allowed to dock and load, but the blockade was reimposed. Patrick Coburn wrote about the consequences of the NATO bombing campaign that destroyed Libya in 2011 and helped assassinate Prime Minister Muammar al-Gaddafi. Spanish National Radio.
On Monday, Turkey rejected a ceasefire in Libya, suggested it would not be in the interests of the GNA, the Government of National Accord, which Turkey supports in the war between the GNA and the Libyan National Army, or LNA, headed by Commander Khalifa Haftar. The Turkish foreign minister said in an interview that the key coastal town of Sirte and the Jufra airbase would have to be turned over to the GNA before there could be any ceasefire. Also on Monday, the LNA and its parliament in the port city of Tobruk called on Egypt to intervene directly in the civil war to counter Turkish support for the GNA. The LNA is backed by the United Arab Emirates, Russia, Egypt, and sometimes France and Greece. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has warned that his army might enter Libya if the GNA and its Turkish allies renew their assault of Sirte, the central coastal city seen as the gateway to Libya's oil export terminals. Reuters reports that since 2014, the two sides, the GNA based in the capital Tripoli and the LNA in Benghazi in the east, have maintained separate governments and military forces backed by international powers. Control over oil, the main source of state revenue, appears to be the biggest prize in the conflict, with Haftar's forces having imposed a blockade on production and exports since January. Under international agreements, only the National Oil Corp, or NOC, based in Tripoli has the right to produce and export oil, while revenues must flow to the Central Bank of Libya, also located in Tripoli. On Friday, international diplomacy, led by the United Nations and the United States, appeared to have ended the oil blockade when a first tanker was allowed to dock at Es Sider and load with oil from storage. However, the LNA on Saturday said that it was reimposing the blockade, a decision that the oil company NOC blamed on the United Arab Emirates. The UAE said it wanted a swift resumption of Libya oil exports, but only if some conditions were met. Turkey agreed to support the GNA after they signed a maritime delimitation deal last year. According to Ankara, the deal creates an exclusive economic zone from Turkey's southern coast to Libya's northeastern coast and protects rights to resources in the eastern Mediterranean. Greece, Cyprus, Malta, and other Mediterranean countries object to the illegal takeover. Turkey's energy minister said that the national oil company had applied for an exploration permit in the eastern Mediterranean and could begin drilling soon. Turkey's foreign minister said he was open to sharing the oil bounty with companies from third countries such as Italy, the United Kingdom, the U.S., and Russia. Let's get some background on Libya and hear from the British newspaper The Independent's former correspondent in Libya, Patrick Coburn, who has written about the consequences of the 2011 NATO bombing campaign that destroyed the country. He writes, "Gaddafi was a dictator, but however horrific the conditions under his rule, Libyans are now at the mercy of local warlords who are proxies for foreign powers pursuing their own egocentric interests. This week, Turkey and Egypt, the coalitions they lead, are close to an all-out proxy war as they face off against each other at Sirte, close to where Gaddafi was killed. This all-consuming violence is not mentioned by the leaders who did so much to bring it about. David Cameron boasts in his autobiography, For the Record, that thanks to his efforts, American, British, and French aircraft stopped the advance of Gaddafi's tanks. He writes, Benghazi was saved and a Srebrenica-style slaughter was averted. Cameron has not noticed that Benghazi was not saved at all. Its center is now a sea of ruins, destroyed in the fighting between the anti-Gaddafi warlords. Cameron's claim that Gaddafi's forces were about to carry out mass killings in Benghazi was always dubious. A report by the Foreign Affairs Select Committee said that the belief that Gaddafi would, quote, massacre the civilians in Benghazi was not supported by the available evidence. His forces had reoccupied several other rebel-held towns, and there had been no massacres. Cameron and Britain were not alone in destroying Libya. In a piece of self-glorifying bombast, as revolting as anything said by Donald Trump, the U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton crowed after the death of Gaddafi, "We came, we saw, he died." So did tens of thousands of other Libyans. But is it naive to imagine that Clinton, Cameron, and Sarkozy ever cared much about what happened to the 7 million Libyan population? They were equally blind in looking after the interests of their own countries when they replaced a broadly secular authoritarian state in Libya with murderous anarchy. That was Patrick Coburn for The Independent.
Those reports by Allison Hughes were from Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio. Spain may be heard at their website rtve.es and by podcast as REE. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Almost all of the funding this freely distributed program receives is from individual listener donations. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help me keep it going like an online listener in Wisconsin did this week. We will conclude with Sputnik Radio. On his program called Orbiting the World, George Galloway spoke with Vaughn Smith, founder of the Frontline Club for Journalists and friend of Julian Assange. They discuss why Assange is the most ignored political prisoner in the world, what is happening to him, that it is a major attack on press freedom, and that any trial will make up a very large chapter in the history of the freedom of speech. Sputnik Radio.
Our guest is Vaughn Smith, the founder of London's famous Frontline Club and a man who cares about his friend Julian Assange. Why is there no press interest in Julian Assange now? That seems to me an extraordinary paradox.
I know quite a few journalists who are interested. For example, Patrick Coburn wrote an extraordinarily good article very recently that I think should help people understand what's really happened. John Simpson, the well-known BBC reporter, chief correspondent, has been writing and trying, and it's all on Twitter, been trying to get a radio, Julian, because he was being denied a radio. So that there are some people who are doing their best to try to help and try and make life a little bit more bearable for Julian. And I certainly think every journalist I speak to is aware of the enormous concern that we should be having in relation to the impacts on our press freedoms. This is a direct attack. Whatever you think of Julian, and there are a range of views out there, what is happening to him is completely wrong. What is happening to him amounts to torture, according to Niels Meltzer, who's a rapporteur on torture for the United Nations. Our treatment of him is appalling, and also there is this appalling threat to the press. So there is journalistic interest, but it is not reflected in our newspapers and our television programs. I completely agree with you that, and that is shocking.
What would be the reason for that?
I think it's partially a media ownership matter. The senior people on the desk are guided by the owners of a media too often, and it doesn't sort of suit owners of newspapers necessarily to support Julian Assange. There are notable exceptions, of course, to that. I think there's also a bit of a crowd mentality. It does take courage, I think, to stand up for Julian Assange. In a way, what's happening to Julian and his treatment is so outrageous. It's so wrong. And we're told that by other countries. We're told that by recently 216 doctors said that he's being tortured. It still somehow is considered to be putting yourself out on a limb to support these things. To an extent, some journalists are a bit sheep-like.
some of the people who perhaps had a leadership role in journalism and could have supported him earlier on felt threatened by him. I mean, as a person, he's done so much in the journalism field that we can spend a career of 30 years getting a couple of great stories, or maybe five, 10, a dozen. But Julian, in one day, was putting out all sorts of stuff of such volume. There's also a kind of professional issue at stake, as a feeling that, you know, he can't possibly, he's not like us, he can't possibly be a journalist. Though we do acknowledge he's a publisher, we're a bit uncomfortable. I think we've got a bit of a chip on our shoulder.
If Julian Assange disappears into the bowels of the American justice system, the chilling effect on future generations of publishers, of journalists, ought to be rather obvious.
I think it is obvious to most people. It's very easy, the manner in which Julian has been smeared online, to come up with something that can justify your lack of courage for standing up for what you really should be believing in. You know, it could be the Swedish matter. Oh, I don't want to be identified with somebody who's got these allegations against them, though they're not anymore. The Hillary Clinton stuff back in 2016. There's enough to blame him for so many people that I think people allow themselves to find him uncomfortable and not prepared to really look at the information. 40 organizations, like the International Federation of Journalism, the National Union of Journalists, PEN, RSF, all these people who are linked to the freedom of the press, 40 organizations have signed a statement saying that Julian should be let out of prison now and these charges should be dropped. So there is support, but it's not reaching the media the way it should.
You mentioned our radio. It took more than 1 year for an unconvicted man in extradition proceedings to be given a radio for his cell. This is quite extraordinary and, on the face of it, is vindictive. Why are they being so?
The vindictiveness is something I referred to earlier. I think it's about vengeance. It's about trying to ensure, whatever the outcome of this legal proceeding, whatever the outcome, that people are dissuaded from following Julian's lead and doing the sort of things he did in terms of displaying what certain governments wish to keep secret from their populations. It's really, I think, about dissuading them. Julian is not receiving the same treatment, the same due process, as other people in this country would expect. I think that's monumentally unfair. I think that undermines us as a country, the sense of fair play we have as a country, are hollowed out by the way Julian Assange is being treated. It doesn't matter what you think about him. It doesn't matter whether you agree what he's doing or has done. Fundamentally, we are judged by the rest of the world, and we can't claim to be the people we claim to be.
Vaughan Smith, thanks for joining us.
That interview is by George Galloway on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts. Please get a global perspective. You could listen to a podcast about the history of the Shortwave Report, that's this program, on Humboldt Lighthouse. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 24th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.